40 years since the break-in at the Watergate Hotel. Did we have a feeling right off the bat that this could develop into something significant as we learned some details about that break-in in the days afterwards?
In the immediate aftermath, no. It looked like, as then Press Secretary Ron Ziegler put it, just a bizarre incident, that this was, you know, sort of political shenanigans of the type that had gone on before. The categorical denials from the White House that they had anything to do with this were largely believed. And for most Americans, it was a non-story, that Gallup polls showed initially that very few Americans knew what had happened or really cared. Attempts by the Democrats, and in particular by George McGovern, to make it a story largely failed. And the Republicans were able to cut off some investigations in the House and slow down the FBI investigation, at least until after the election.
Yeah, did it initially seem like it was something only of interest to people within the Beltway?
That's how it seemed, and that's how it was portrayed. In fact, listening to some of the tapes during 1972, that's what H.R. Haldeman is telling Richard Nixon, that it's just a Beltway story. It'll go away. The rest of the country doesn't care.
It didn't go away. Why?
In part because there was more to it. In part because, as Nixon knew right from the outset, this was real potential trouble. The Nixon administration had engaged in this kind of behavior before. Many of the men involved in the Watergate break-in had been utilized by the plumbers, the leak prevention specialists, I suppose, from the Nixon administration to try and embarrass Daniel Ellsberg. They had broken into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, successfully breaking in, unsuccessfully finding anything on Ellsberg, and moved over to the committee to reelect the president. So it's a pattern of behavior more so than this one incident. Indeed, this was the actual second successful break-in at Watergate. They had planted bugs initially and photographed documents a couple weeks earlier and had tried to break in two previous times. They also had two unsuccessful break-in attempts at McGovern's headquarters. So it's not just an isolated incident, and it's part of this sort of pattern of behavior that the Nixon administration felt that people were their enemies. And if you were their enemies, they had the right to do whatever they had to bring you into line.
The dirty tricks of the Nixon administration, we hear that term sometimes. This was just more of that?
This is more of that, but it's when you say dirty tricks, it's a little bit more serious than that. There are some actual dirty tricks, like lying about candidates, Democratic candidates, holding programs, stealing their papers and sending out news releases under their names, trying to turn the Democrats against each other. This goes a little beyond that, in that you're breaking and entering. You're engaging in electronic surveillance. The Nixon administration also was not shy about using the IRS to conduct audits against perceived enemies to try and discourage political behavior by people that they didn't like. So it's not just dirty tricks. It's using the power of government to try and repress.
What were these burglars seeking this time during this break-in at the Watergate?
Well, part of the second break-in was to fix bugs placed in the first break-in. One of them wasn't actually working. As to their actual motives, there's a whole host of potential reasons. Part of it was to try and figure out what the Democrats were going to use against Nixon during the campaign. Nixon's family had some connections to the reclusive billionaire Howard Hughes. His brother had taken a couple of loans from Hughes. There were some concerns about what was known about Nixon's relationship with Bebe Rebozo. There was also some concerns about potential things that Democrats might try to do during the campaign. The motives are all over the place. Most of them are political. Some of them are personal for Nixon. There are a host of sort of, for lack of a better way to put it, less savory motives that have been offered by some to try and sort of deflect blame from the Nixon administration. But most of it is political.
Did Nixon really need to do these types of things to win the election?
By that point, no. What you have to keep in mind is when these things were planned, Nixon was not doing very well in the polls. That for most of 1971, Nixon was seen as a potential one-term president. that as late as January of 72, Gallup polls had him running in a dead heat with the Democratic frontrunner Edmund Muskie. So in the immediate weeks after that Gallup poll is when this program was planned, when G. Gordon Liddy met with John Mitchell, the head of Nixon's campaign, and talked about what would become known as Operation Gemstone, the Intelligence and Dirty Tricks campaign. And so at the time they were being planned, these seemed necessary. By June, not so much. By June, George McGovern's the front runner. He's the person that Nixon wants to run against. And so it's not seemingly as necessary. That said, some of those dirty tricks helped put McGovern in that place. It had influenced who the Democrats chose. So yes and no.
All right. At what point did this become of greater interest to the general public? When did we really start to see how serious this was?
A little bit before the election. The Woodward and Bernstein stories that start coming out in the Washington Post in September and October of 1972 begin the process, but it's not really until after the election with the new Congress appointing – or really specifically the new Senate appointing a select committee to investigate these matters that you start making this into a national story. The Woodward and Bernstein thing does begin to take it outside of the Beltway, but even then the stories in the Post stop a couple of weeks before the election, and really not very many other papers outside of the LA Times pick up the stories prior to November.
How important were Woodward and Bernstein to this whole thing, and how much had more to do with the select committee?
From my perspective, Woodward and Bernstein helped direct the investigation a little bit by emphasizing the money trail, by emphasizing the FBI's lack of activity beyond the original indictments. On September the 15th of 72, the grand jury investigating the case only indict the five burglars, G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt, and say those are the only people involved. Woodward and Bernstein's articles make it clear that there's more to it than that, that the committee to reelect the president's involved, that there are probably higher ups in the White House involved, and so that there is more to look into. It's the Senate Select Committee, though, that takes this ball and runs with it and turns it not into a national story, but starts putting real pressure on the Nixon administration that they are going to have to respond to this. Much of what the Nixon administration did prior to the election was just deny it.
How much of this is the type of thing that would have been done by presidents in the past, or did Nixon really rise above or below that, I guess?
Well, I think Nixon rises below that, but there is a little bit of precedent, at least for Nixon, at least as far as Nixon was concerned. Lyndon Johnson used the FBI against anti-war protesters. The FBI had a program codenamed COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, infiltrating anti-war groups, infiltrating the Black Panthers. So Nixon felt justified. In fact, Nixon felt sort of unfairly picked on when the Supreme Court in 1970 ruled that these sorts of wiretappings and break-ins could not just be justified by saying national security. You actually had to prove that there was a national security reason for doing it. And so Nixon felt that since the court was being unfair to him, he had a right to go out and do what he wanted to do and conduct these operations outside of using the FBI.
Nixon resigned in August of 74. At what point does it become clear that we're headed toward that point?
Probably as early as October of 73. The turning point for Nixon is what becomes known as the Saturday Night Massacre, when Nixon forces out the special prosecutor who had been subpoenaing tapes, and his attorney general and assistant attorney general refuse to fire the special prosecutor and both resign. When Nixon gets the special prosecutor fired and then has the FBI come in and seal his offices, it looks like a push. It looks like a political maneuver. And that's the point at which the House starts to consider impeachment proceedings seriously.
Do you think he would have eventually been removed from office if he had not resigned?
Yes, I think there's little doubt. All of the members of the House Judiciary Committee that voted against impeachment said they would have voted for impeachment on the floor of the House after the release of the tapes. His supporters in the Senate had dwindled to maybe five. Senator Barry Goldwater, in fact, told Nixon as much a couple of days before he resigned, that you have maybe five votes in the Senate to keep you in office, and I'm not one of them. And so for Nixon, the likelihood of removal was stark. And if he's removed, he loses his pension, he loses all the perks of being an ex-president, and he's probably going to be subject to prosecution.
He eventually was not prosecuted. He was pardoned by President Gerald Ford, his successor. Do you think perhaps we could have learned more if this had gone to trial?
I think we definitely would have learned more. However, I don't really see how that would have happened. Ford is thinking about doing this from the outset of becoming president. He wants Nixon to just go away. He knows there's really not much to do to help the Republican Party in the midterm elections in 1974, but he wants the Nixon problem to be gone by 1976, and this is the only way to do it. In a sense, Ford falls on his sword for the Republican Party. A trial of Richard Nixon would have taken years and would have kept this scandal in the public eye and tarnished the Republican Party right into almost the 1980s. By just pardoning Nixon, you make him go away. Now, the downside of that is it allows Nixon to avoid any sort of public reckoning. It allows Nixon to avoid admitting to doing anything wrong, and it allows Nixon to spend the rest of his life fighting to keep his records from becoming public and perhaps, you know, closing most of these questions about what Nixon knew and when he knew it.
Doesn't it also sort of create the impression that some people are above the law?
It absolutely does. And it has the unintentional consequence of not bringing any closure to the matter. It confirms what Nixon wants people to believe, and that this is all just political. That it's not that I committed illegal acts. It's not that I violated the Constitution as well as federal law. It's just the Democrats being spoil sports because they lost the election. And that attitude helps poison the partisan relations right into the 21st century.
I was going to ask you, how do you think Watergate still affects us today? Does it?
It does. It turns it into an era of hyperpartisanship. Prior to this point, if you read about relations among senators and among congressmen, with a handful of exceptions, they at least accepted that members of the other party were doing what was best for America. They may not agree with their positions and stances, but at least you agreed that we were all working for the same goal, which Nixon did as president and then as ex-president is emphasize the politics of division. That's Nixon's stock and trade, that you're not just my opponent, you're my enemy. You're not just wrong, you're evil. And so that bringing that to the table and bringing that to the fore becomes an integral part of American politics through to today, that you can't work together, that if you agree to compromise, you're betraying the cause.
In issuing the pardon, Ford famously said our long national nightmare is over, but it sounds like it's not.
No, unfortunately, although Richard Nixon's presidency is over, as well as his life by this point, his legacy lives with us in a very divisive and divided American political spectrum.
You've done quite a bit of research on Watergate and on the Nixon presidency. Why are you so interested in that?
In part because of the long-term impact. Nixon is a fascinating figure. His presidency, it comes at a turning point in American history. He does get the United States out of the war in Vietnam. He does restore relations with China, for better or worse in the long term. He does dominate, in a way, American politics from the end of World War II until his resignation. And for historians, beyond that, since Nixon's actions do two things, good and bad. One is it allows for the creation of the Presidential Records and Recordings Act, which makes presidential records public property. Up until the Nixon administration, presidential records were owned by the president, and they could do whatever they wanted with them after they left office. Now they're required to hand them over to the National Archives, open a presidential library, and open them to the public. That said, since Nixon spent the rest of his life in court trying to keep his records from being read, it slows the process and sets a precedent for other presidents. Reagan administration records should be open now. They're really not. They're opening very, very slowly because you have this precedent of fighting that rear guard action if you don't want what you did to become public knowledge.
Would you say Richard Nixon was his own worst enemy?
Absolutely. Nixon had those inner demons that drove him throughout his life. The same things that made him ambitious enough and self-confident enough to become president of the United States also drove him to, again, see anybody who was an opponent as an enemy, to have deep and abiding hatreds, to have deep and abiding grudges, and to never, ever let them go.
And he did. I mean, you touched on a couple of his accomplishments. I believe the EPA was also created during his administration. I mean, he did some good things, but it's all overshadowed, of course, by Watergate, isn't it?
With Nixon, every silver lining has a cloud. Nixon didn't really think too much about domestic policy. He saw he couldn't prevent things from happening and so took credit for them. He didn't really support the EPA's creation, but he couldn't stop it, so he might as well reap the political benefit. That's just fine. That's a perfectly logical thing for a president to do. The problem for Nixon is it's not enough that he succeeds. Everyone else must fail.
Anything you want to add about this? Anything I didn't touch on you think people should know?
Well, I think it's important to remember that this is still a crucial element in American political life, that it's not just an anomaly, that Nixon's actions and behaviors and the response of the Democrats and the response of the country affect American politics right through to today. Also, it's important to remember that Nixon's involved from this in the start, that there's a tendency, you know, to sort of allow the dead to rest in peace and try and sort of revise your memories of what happened. Nixon's involved from Watergate from the start. He runs all of his own campaigns right from his very first one. So he is intimately involved in the process. He may not have planned the break-in. He was aware it happened, and he took charge of the cover-up. And that's a violation of the law. Regardless of what Nixon would later say to David Frost, the president does it does not mean it's above the law.
Do you think the attempts to the Republican attacks on Bill Clinton are a response to Watergate? Hey, you got one of our guys, so we have to get one of yours now.
I think that's absolutely the case. If you think about some of the people who were involved in those attacks, in particular in the Senate side, Trent Lott, he's a member of the House. He's one of the last people who said that he won't vote for Nixon's impeachment because you never vote for your own party's president to be impeached. And so, yes, there is definitely a sense of you got one of ours, we got one of yours, and that's part of Nixon's legacy.
All right. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Rich.